LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Joe Biden and senility. Is it time for America's big box media to honestly confront the issue? Perhaps. And Hunter Biden's emails are now apparently a real story when they were fake news before the last presidential election. LibertyNation.com's senior political analyst Tim Donner joins us for the full show for these issues and a preview of the new way of doing oral arguments at the Supreme Court, which starts its new term October 4. We'll talk about Amy Coney Barrett's first full term as a Supreme Court justice and whether they will allow Puerto Ricans to cockfight, all on this uprising. Let's get this show on the road. Joining us once
again. I like
again,
the way you changed the subject. That was good.
On the Uprising podcast is LibertyNation.com senior political analyst, Mr. Timothy Elting Donner. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm a little suspicious of your hyper emphasis on the word senior. I'm not that old.
That's to your credit, sir. But you're not the junior.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's all in the eye of the beholder, but thank you for the introduction.
You know, not that this is age related, but we've talked before about your issues with your voice on the uprising. And I just wanted to tell people that you're going for broke. You've got a problem with your voice that may be one thing and maybe another, and you're taking a treatment that will either make it a lot worse or a lot better.
Well, it's true. It could possibly do nothing, but
and for some small part of that decision, I think, is for the benefit of the uprising audience and the audience of LibertyNation.com. So we wish you luck and keep our fingers crossed for that. But
thank you.
You're welcome.
That's coming up very shortly. So it'll sound worse if that's possible, or better, which is definitely possible. It's a it's an unusual condition that presents itself in two different ways. And the two treatments that are called for can clash with one another and make things worse. So it's one of these things where you have to be your own case manager, because you go to a series of doctors and one tells you one thing, another tells you another, and they're all experts. But it's it's all based on
like vaccine science.
Yeah. Oh, please. Let's hope.
All right. We're going to try to get away without saying the V word. I won't do it again. Let's go into talking about the Bidens.
Yes. The Bidens. You know, we're going to bring Dr. Jill in.
There was one part of America and the federal the giant federal bureaucracy and government that we have that I thought would actually improve somewhat significantly under a Joe Biden presidency. I thought really, like, if we were to look in hindsight as to what the leadership of Biden got us, there'd be one point where we could say, well, this particular thing has improved markedly.
I've got one thing
since Joe Biden. Well, hold on just a second.
Just one.
It turns out I was wrong about that.
Oh my God, it's on its side.
Cell phones captured the aftermath, but tonight the NTSB confirms multiple train-mounted cameras were rolling before and after the deadly Amtrak derailment. Traveling just under the 79-mile-per-hour speed limit, the agency says passengers may have been ejected.
We're literally thrown out of our chairs, my father and I. It was unlike anything that I have ever felt.
After multiple 911 calls,
911, where's your emergency?
Hi, I'm an Amtrak train in Montana that just crashed.
It was mostly volunteers who raced to the scene in the middle of rural Montana.
train's destroyed down there.
Zack Snyder is one of the three who lost their lives. His wife somehow survived. Dozens were injured, five hospitalized. With the NTSB piecing together Saturday's crash, Amtrak's Empire Builder was traveling west with two locomotives and 10 cars. On a fairly straight stretch of tracks, at least five cars suddenly derailed, three plowing off the tracks entirely near Joplin. With more than 150 on board, the train was equipped with positive train control, a safety feature that virtually prevents all derailments from human error.
We'll be looking at the mechanical condition of the train. We'll be looking at the human factors of the crew. We'll be looking at the people who inspected the track. We'll be looking at the track conditions.
BNSF, who maintains the track, said the rail had just been inspected days earlier. Tonight, the widening probe for answers after a tragedy on the tracks.
And Miguel, we know from previous accidents that some of these trains are equipped with recorders, including this one, right?
Yeah, that's right, Lester. Investigators have recovered the black box. In addition to the speed, it'll tell them if braking was applied. Couple that with the onboard video, and you'll have some powerful clues.
Now, Tim, I'm not making light of the deaths of the people who perished on that Amtrak train, but if Amtrak was if it wasn't a federal government endeavor, right, if it was Amtrak private train cars, how many of these derailments accidents would we have tolerated as a country before we drove them into bankruptcy?
Let me just do a point of privilege here for a second. This always seems to happen right before my wife and I or our family scheduled to fly.
Right.
There's some huge crash.
that's got to be a psychological.
And this week, for the first time in months, we were scheduled to take the train up to New York. Mm-hmm. The day before we take the train is the Amtrak derailment in Montana. Right. And suddenly it's like, you know, now my wife is on edge where she ordinarily is only somewhat on edge. Right.
Well, Tim, you travel on the important people train. This was in Montana. I don't know that they had applied the same.
This is the non-income producing portion of Amtrak out west. But you're right. It's since it's, you know, all the time when I ride Amtrak and I've ridden it for a number of years, I always look at it through the lens of, if this was not a government run operation, how different would this be? Would that be? How different would the service be? How different would the food be? How different would the on-timeness be? And that's probably the best example of a huge enterprise that could be run, of course,
I think
privately, and probably better. But the other
there actually would be food if it were privately run.
Here's the thing too, though. For certain, if Amtrak was sold to private interests, they would shrink the number of available routes substantially, because right now it's only Boston wide, the so-called Bowash corridor, that's actually profitable for them there.
Maybe if they provided a superior service, that some of those other routes would be profitable. So I don't grant the premise of
this is a government operation. Superior right. service doesn't really enter the equation.
Yeah. You know what? You know what's funny? You know what's funny? Just hold that point for a second, because a lot of people would say, you're right, superior service doesn't. But what you get instead of superior service is reliability and safety and lower prices. And the funny thing about Amtrak is you got none of those three. It's unreliable, it's not safe, and it's prohibitively expensive.
Other than that, it's a superb,
all right.
It's a superb operation.
We're not going to focus on the train schedules for any more.
The thing is that I'm sort of forced to use it because I live in a spot where I have family in New York that I try to visit. My parents are very elderly now, and so I have to take the train a fair amount. And it's like the least bad of a number of bad options. You can drive to New York and go through the traffic of New York and basically be in a state of nervous breakdown by the time you get there. You can take a plane, but by the time you get through security and then wait for delays and go through all of that rigmarole, it's not worth it. So it's like the train for all its Inefficiency is still the best option.
They still managed to lose money, even on that most revenue-producing corridor.
Scott, trains are, look, far too important an operation to concern ourselves so with profits. Yeah. I mean, certainly we don't care about profits. This is
the best thing is when they pile like an insane amount of money into something. And then, of course, when you bring up that like it's not working or it doesn't work and it's going to cost another insane amount, then the argument is like, well, we've got this giant infrastructure. We can't just abandon these jobs. And these
right.
Things,
so we just have to spend more because spending more will fix it. Well, this is what this $3.5 trillion, you know, what I call all you can eat buffet of socialist wish list items that they want to throw into this reconciliation bill. You know, it's like just anything that can be passed by
whatever we can write down. That's
the kitchen sink. It's a kitchen sink.
Hey, if somebody is giving out free money, right, and you're in the vicinity, what are you gonna ask for? A sensible, reliable family car? Are you gonna go ask for?
I've heard people, you know, say to a conservative, "You're against Social Security, so why do you take the check?" Well, because if it's available, What am I supposed to turn away on principle? Because if it's a good deal for me personally, I'm going to take it. Doesn't mean that deal should be available to begin with.
Yeah, that's the one-step thinking, of course. It's like,
exactly.
You tell them that the most rabid capitalist that ever lived, Ayn Rand, said that anytime you're offered government money, you take it. That's the repayment of stolen goods. You just can't advocate for it. That's what the right. prohibition is. You can't say, hey, we should have more spending and more programs. But if the government's offering you a check, take it and cash it and consider yourself lucky to get some rebate on the stolen goods. All right, let's go ahead and move along to I want to focus on a couple of topics that I think are related. You wrote a piece for the sponsor of today's program, LibertyNation.com, this week, Tim, talking about the Pandora's box of the media and their coverage of Biden's mental state. Mm-hmm. And let's start off with this.
But I want to start with something that Chris Smith touched on this program last night. The Joe Biden gaffes, the stumbles, the confusion, they just continue and they get worse. Seriously, his staff probably can't wait to get him home to bed in the White House. But before he does that, the president has to go face to face with Russian President Vladimir Putin, which is a big worry, given what I'm about to show you. And believe me, most of the media just doesn't show you this stuff. Now, some of these clips are a bit long, but I want you to get a proper sense of what's going on here, a proper sense of how the US president is handling it. First up, top of the agenda between Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin ought to be Syria. But in the lead-up, the US president seems to confuse that country with Libya.
We could work together with Russia, for example, in Libya. We should be opening up the passes to be able to go through and provide food assistance and vital assistance to a population that's in real trouble. I think I'm going to try very much hard to. And by the way, there's places where. I shouldn't be starting off and negotiating in public here, but let me say it this way. Russia has engaged in activities which we believe are contrary to international norms, but they have also bitten off some real problems they're going to have trouble chewing on. And, for example, the rebuilding of Syria, of Libya, of, you know, this is, they're there.
Oh, sorry. Was that Biden talking? Yeah, I mean, it's like a rambling stream of consciousness that sort of throws together a series of facts in an incoherent, rambling fashion, which does not exactly
excuse me, Tim. Stop that right now. That's the president of the United States, and he was barely coherent. He wasn't incoherent. He was barely coherent.
Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize to the listeners for saying what I said, and I issue a full retraction.
A little respect
immediately. Yes. Well, look, This is a thing. What I wrote in the column was that this prominent writer for USA Today, Jill Lawrence, who's, she writes a lot of inflammatory, anti-conservative, Trump deranged kind of stuff. And of course, the Trump people and anybody, frankly, who was paying attention could hardly help but notice that the Joe Biden of 2020 was hardly the Joe Biden that we'd seen before, who, even if you didn't like anything about him, was a guy who could battle, could get on the stage, and he didn't act like he was out of it.
I've been impressed by your documentarian sort of logging of Biden's mental acuity before he ran for president this time. I mean, like, you remarked on it before about his brain aneurysm and how he was decidedly a different person as observed from the outside before and after.
And again, we have to talk about this because the elite media doesn't, and they should have. And that is the fact that not once, but twice within 3 months in 19, either 89 or 90, Joe Biden suffered brain aneurysms. Now, some people die from an aneurysm. Most don't. But once you have a second one on top of the first, and in short order, 3 months later, suddenly his chances of having normal brain functioning generically for someone with two aneurysms as close goes from about 80% functioning to about 50% chance of full normal functioning. So there's that. Now, whether that, you know, that's a way above my pay grade to say whether that could lead to this premature dementia.
Well, the thing that,
because after all, Scott, he's 78 or maybe 79. You know, he's not 90. And my parents are in their 90s, and they're far more coherent and clear-headed, it seems, when they talk, than he is. But they see, here's the thing, but the point is that by bringing this up, Jill Lawrence, this writer for USA Today, is arguing against something that's been basically whispered sotto voce, you know, under the radar on the down
low. Thank you for the Latin there. I love it.
You know, Biden.
Classing up the podcast.
Biden isn't what he used to be. I mean, are you noticing?
Well, people have to recall, there was a mountain of front page above the fold. And for those of us, I guess I'm too old to make those. I shouldn't make that reference anymore. That's a newspaper reference for the young folks. But leading story A block presentation about Donald Trump's mental fitness for office, with all kinds of prestigious university psychiatrists and psychologists weighing in on it, and to the negative, by the way. But we don't see it for Biden. And that's you talk about Pandora's box. Are we going to see more examination of this?
Well,
is this a real thing, or is this just like
the kind of thing, Scott, where the right is not very comfortable talking about it fully, openly.
I don't think I've played maybe one other clip of Biden doing his gaffes and his mumbling and his weird whispering.
I mean, there's just so here. It's so much of it. There's a critical mass.
Well, not only that, but it can be like ad hominem. And I want, Liberty Nation, is not there for ad hominem attacks on others. It's for presentation of ideas.
Look,
and I attack Biden.
There were plenty of.
Well, hold on. Let me just say this. But there can become a kind of critical mass where you think, all right, it's not just politics in terms of attacks. It's a real thing, perhaps. And so that's what I'm asking. Is this a real thing, or is this just a political?
The way I put it is this. When Biden ran for office, you could object to his ideology. You could object to the fact he was a career politician. You could object to his choice of a running mate. You could object to his policy priorities. You could object to all of that. And that's just politics. But the part that so many objected to, which is beyond politics, which was a genuine concern, which is now presenting itself, is his neurological health. And the fact that he presents almost, look, it's It's unambiguous evidence of early dementia. How early is the question? To what extent is it beyond someone who's at such an advanced age? Do most people, for example, have a little bit of dementia or some when they turn 78, 79? The answer is no. But here's the thing. In this article, this is sort of typical of what happened when you tried to bring it up in 2020. And of course, his neurological state was overridden by the pandemic, the economy, you know, half of urban America being burned down. All these things took precedence, so people didn't pay the kind of attention they should have. But here was what one professor who defended Biden against the charge of being a dementia or being senile in 2020, is ago. It's a shameful display of ageism and ignorance, said Donald Jurevich, a distinguished professor of geriatrics at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Now, here you go. The word senile may create a mental picture of someone who has stooped posture, is slow moving, and cognitively impaired. I don't think any of those descriptors match Joe Biden's demeanor and vigor, he said. Really? You just described.
Yeah.
He just described Joe Biden is stooped when he walks. He walks like your grandfather used to walk in his declining years, right? Probably
stooped over.
Yeah. Right. Slow moving. Wow. I mean, it's like every step is an epic.
I don't even think that the pace is it. It's the kind of the more of it is when people correct him for all the basic things like, oh, no, we're over here now. We have to turn this way. This is where the cameras are. This is where your paper is.
Yeah,
this is what we're talking about today. Evidence. You know,
and look, I think, look, I don't think it's too much of a leap to say when you question or to when you're questioning about dementia. To say, would a president who is in some stage of dementia be more likely to ignore the universal advice of the State Department, of the Defense Department, of the chief?
You mean
of
like
staff?
The generals that tell you leave 3,500 people behind at an airport?
All of it
to make sure that.
And then he doesn't. Is that a sign? Because it's against all odds. It's against all logic, Scott. You and I, with our zero military experience, would know that.
Am I a video game?
You don't pull out all your military before the evacuation. I mean, so is that a sign of dementia that he would willingly reject advice that is pretty much on the face of it obvious from all of his top advisors? To me, that could be a sign of his mental decline. And if it is, then we're really in dangerous territory because this guy's got more than 3 years to go, Scott.
Boy, you forget about that, right? It does seem like it's been more than it has.
It's not parliamentary system
if he serves out his full term, which
it seems increasingly
we'll see about that. And just on a personal note, Tim, you denigrate my electronic service. I'm not a former member of the armed forces, but I have played video games where I do serve in a military capacity. So let's get that straight.
I did it too. And I want to tell you, I offed thousands of people. Thousands.
Hey,
slaughtering enemies.
That's why you got the 1,000-yard East Air. All right.
Another story. I don't.
Another story that seems to be like it was in the ghetto from the big box legacy media perspective. It was in the ghetto of we don't talk about that. That's a stinky gutter story. To now, it seems like maybe there's a real there is the Hunter Biden laptop and email story.
And we don't, you know, it's interesting that the emails that have come out in recent days don't, as I understand it, aren't even from the laptop. In other words, they weren't plucked from the laptop.
Right, yeah.
They were released another way. So this story, look, if it was
let me just stop you there and say they have confirmed this. This is now like the most confirmed piece of intelligence or whatever that you can even imagine. I saw this one thing just to give an example of how they've gone to confirm it. Hunter Biden exchanged some emails with, I think, the Swedish embassy I think it was the Swedish anyway, or the Swiss, started with an S and it's over in that region. That's not the important part. They got the release of these documents, and because of the formatting for the email that they got, they confirmed that it was Hunter's email with these other things. So in other words, going to other official government sources for the record. And we know like it's just not credible to suggest, if you say that this is not Hunter's email, you should be the one now, like the burden should have shifted. Okay. It seems like the proof is
out there.
You
have to prove
there, right?
It. It's not.
So people are reasonable.
It's his. It is his laptop. I think there's just that question was put to bed before the election, I think, if not shortly thereafter, by people that looked into it, still pissed off that it was not looked into by the elite media during the final stage of the election, because it would have, there was a poll that was done of people in the swing states that Biden won that asked voters if they were aware of the Hunter Biden laptop story. And of course, like 60% were not aware. And of the people that weren't, enough of them, when they were given the facts of it, said they would have changed their vote, would have not voted for Biden. Enough of them would have.
There's one thing about these emails that would have swung it to Trump. I think, Tim, every major news organization would, and I'm not talking now about great news organizations like LibertyNation.com, which has a more limited kind of flood the zone reporting for sending people on location for a long time to kind of dig into something. And that's what I expect out of these legacy media kind of types. And if it were Trump or some non-Democrat, I feel like there's one part of those emails, and this is the smoking gun, I think, if you will, or the thing that needs to be really investigated, which is that Hunter Biden says in these deals, the people he's communicating with is, should we reserve 10, or we're reserving 10% for the big guy.
The big guy.
Okay. And who is the big guy if it's not?
Oh, could be anybody. Could be anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's look, the story was obvious when it came out. It was, I don't know which was more shocking, the story itself last October, or the fact that the mainstream media buried it without even looking at it. They didn't look at it. They didn't examine it.
They looked at it enough to know that it could be really damaging to Biden's candidacy.
They did not reject
it. And then they buried it.
But they never once said, we rejected it because we found it wanting. We rejected it because it's not real. We rejected it for any reason other than the fact that they wanted to reject it.
Tim, here's Glenn Greenwald.
The evidence was overwhelming from the very beginning, Tucker, that the emails were authentic, and yet they lied and lied and lied, as you just showed, trying to convince people to not even pay attention to them on the grounds that they were disinformation, that the emails were fake. Now, the new book that just came out is from this young reporter at Politico who spent months digging into all of these emails. And obviously, had he unearthed proof that these emails were forgeries and put that in his book, he would be a star. You would know his name. He'd be a household name. He'd be on every TV show. But because his reporting said the opposite, he found even more proof that all those emails were authentic, which meant that these media outlets, all of them pretty much, with a few exceptions, deliberately lied to the public in the weeks before the election by telling them that this was Russian disinformation when they knew it wasn't true. They're ignoring his book. He's not a right-wing journalist. He's from one of the most mainstream publications. He has the proof in his hands that they all lied and they don't want anyone to know it.
See, Russian disinformation, that was the mantra of the resistance.
The old Soviet playbook, Tim.
Right. Everything was Russian disinformation. That's right. Now, I'll tell you what. To me, what what just Tim, sort of Tim, puts the final, me, just... well, let me finish. What puts the final nail in the coffin of these swamp creatures who want to protect the status quo at all costs is that you had 60 former intelligence and military officials leaders.
That's what I was going
to
say.
Who said it's Russian disinformation.
They signed their names to the receipt on that lie.
That's correct. And they affected the outcome of the election with their false assurance that this was Russian disinformation. But it would have been one thing if they were misguided. But they deliberately lied because they knew damn well it wasn't Russian information. And this is the deep state.
Well, wait a second. Maybe they didn't know. I actually don't even grant you that part of your argument where you say they didn't know. I just think they didn't care.
Well, what I'm saying is
this is a way to sell, right? In other words, it doesn't matter if it's Russian disinformation.
But these people are in the know. They know when something is Russian
or if you're disinformation. And if you're Brennan,
I'm sure the real reaction was, oh no. Hunter, he didn't. It makes sense. He would do something like that because he was spun out on crack and lined up like dime store hookers from back alleys. I mean, the stories are unbelievable of this guy, you know. And I mean, you just apparently, because I went to a event last week where some of the stuff that was on that laptop was being described. And I mean, the debauchery, we'll just say the real debauchery across the board of Hunter Biden was kind of like
soulless existence of a person who's in the very, very depths of a crisis of their existence with drugs and alcohol and everything
else.
I think
the signs of someone who's self-destructive in the sense that it seems like Hunter Biden was called on for years to do the dirty work, to do the
bag man
for his family. He was the bag man.
I have nothing
but
pity.
I have nothing but pity
for Hunter Biden. He's a victim, survivor of Joe Biden. But
yeah, I mean, look, the what's on the Hunter Biden laptop in terms of his own debauchery, that's his own personal thing. He's not elected to anything. It's what's revealed in there about the way that the Biden crime family, as it's now being called, did business. And, you know, and the big guy just stands there, lets his son do all the dirty, nefarious deals, and he just rakes 10% right off the top of every deal. And these deals, Scott, some of these deals involving China are multi-billion dollar deals.
You know what, Tim, for a man who's dedicated himself to public service for nearly his entire adult life,
he's entitled to it.
Yeah, I don't like those kind of...
He's entitled to it. No. You know what, he's entitled to his 10%.
That kind of disparaging remark is not terribly welcome.
Now, Scott, look, tell me, don't you think a 10% VIG is worthwhile for all his 49 years of government service?
Let him make the taxes 10%, right? That it's not that big a that's a good a rubric for everything. Go 10%, cut it back. All right, let's go ahead and lay off the Bidens for a minute and talk about the Supreme Court. We're recording on the 30th of September, and on the 4th of October, which is Monday, the Supreme Court will start its new term of argument. Tim, now before we get to the sort of more substantive talk, and we're not going to go deep on abortion or guns because I think we've already done that for the audience. There's actually a change in argument in the way the structure of the argument works. So the Supreme Court, when the coronavirus came in and everybody was making changes to their operations because of it, they went all virtual. The justices and the attorneys are all like via Zoom from their own offices. Famously, one judge was in the bathroom. You heard a toilet. Yeah. Justices, you heard a toilet.
The most famous toilet flush in Supreme Court history.
There you go. And they're now returning to the courtroom for the lawyers and the judges, but not the public. Tim, we're not invited to the court. They said on their website that they anticipate broadcasting the audio of the proceedings, but they didn't say they would. They just said they anticipate, and there's going to be some national pool reporters in the building as well. But so that the change is that it used to be the Supreme Court. So this is going to get a little bit deep into the weeds, but most people don't understand. So maybe we'll be educational here and learn people something about how this works. When you're arguing before the Supreme Court, one party goes up, they state their case. Then the other party goes up, they state their case. And typically both sides will, or especially the first side, will leave time for rebuttal, okay? So they get to then go back up. They reserve a certain portion of their argument time to go back up and kind of challenge what the other side said. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third wildcard component, which is the United States Solicitor General is who's a Justice Department employee and a presidential appointee, is sometimes invited by the Supreme Court to offer their own arguments in the case, even though they're not actually a party to the case. So maybe there's a state law issue that the feds want to weigh in on, and they'll be allowed to do that because of their position in the government. Okay. Now, what had happened, Tim, during argument before the pandemic is the second the attorney says the word, usually they start with, may it please the court. As soon as they start to go into their argument, any justice may interrupt them and question them. Now, typically they give them couple 30 seconds or a minute and a half before they launch in, and then justices interrupt each other and interrupt the litigants. Now, it's not done to talk over the person. It's done to expose a legal point or draw something out. So it's not done disrespectfully or in a way that you can't hear the communication, but it is a kind of free-for-all. That mm-hmm. stopped during the Zoom call because, as we're sometimes guilty of, if you talk over somebody, it's not like a regular conversation. It cuts in and out, and it's confusing to the ear. So they stop.
I've been trying to get you to stop that for years without success.
I appreciate that. Say. Thank you so much for your kind efforts.
Welcome.
So
you're very welcome.
So Scott, what they did was they went through, and just like if we were doing it between you and I, by seniority, you would go first, for instance, in the questioning. And that's how the justice
barely
did it. That's how and what happened was Clarence Thomas, Tim, who didn't ask a question for over 10 years in oral arguments, started asking questions all the time. And other justices did too. And they basically, what I think the discovery is, not that it's particularly earth shattering, but to generate the will and the inertia to interrupt someone is a lot different than responding when called on. Okay.
Right. Right.
And Clarence Thomas doesn't interrupt. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to mix it up like that. But when he's called on to ask his question, he does. And they're good questions. Anyway, they've now gone to a hybrid system for the new term. So they're going to do that free-for-all part initially, or not initially, at the beginning part of an argument. And then later on in the argument, they're going to go do this. Now it's your turn. Now it's my turn. Now it's the other person's turn from seniority, from Roberts on down to Barrett. So that should be interesting to see how it works out. For those of us that are enthralled by the actual arguments themselves and how it all takes place, it's going to be a big change to see what happens with this new argument structure.
Is there any way that you would say this could affect the way decision-making is done sufficiently to overturn somebody's, change somebody's mind in some sense because of the new procedural aspects? I mean, I wouldn't think that any Supreme Court justice must be so advanced in his or her thinking that the order of questioning and stuff wouldn't make much
difference. I believe it will. Now, I don't think it's going to make a difference on whether or not we have legal abortion or people can carry guns or not, right? You have to remember the Supreme Court settles so many. The first case up, I think it's the first case, is this case between the Mississippi and Tennessee over water rights. Tennessee apparently is a private well company or water company that pumped out like a couple billion gallons of water from under Mississippi. And they're suing to see who can control. Like, so these are things that, like, you know, we live nowhere near Mississippi or Tennessee, and we presume that those people are going to have water to drink, and we don't really, you know, not that we don't care what happens.
Don't
to
pay
them,
much attention. Right.
We don't really care about it. And it's not an issue that's going to really lead the news outside of that geographic area. We're not going to hear about that report. I'm not going to write about it for the pages of the sponsor of today's podcast, LibertyNation.com, where I do cover the more contentious issues on the court. It's just not going to be a thing. But I bet you there will be a justice who says something in an argument like that that makes another justice approach it from a little bit of a different angle. People can get kind of welled in or siloed with the arguments they're considering,
right,
for instance. So I just think that, yes, I do think that the more of those, and they, unlike my arguments, sad to say, I don't think Sonia Sotomayor is looking for them or necessarily respecting them. But even though she probably disagrees with Justice Thomas, I think there is a lot of collegiality on the court and willingness to at least consider what one of the other justices is saying. So I think the answer to your question is yes, it will lead to some. We may never hear about it, or we may hear about it 20 years later when they write their memoirs. But I think it will.
We hear a lot about collegiality on the court and the deference and respect that the justices have for one another. But are you familiar with any relationships that were famously strained on the Supreme Court, like where one justice really couldn't stand another? Or
no, I'm not. And I think that that's probably because the personal stories of the justices are not widely reported, like
yes,
the congresspersons, right, and the presidents. There right, are deep and abiding friendships you hear about, but you don't hear much about animosity, and right, they do a good job of
making sure you don't anything, hear,
yeah,
about it.
Yeah. And if people think they are, then they kind of, you know, in other words, if people think that justices are at odds because of their writings or something like that, you know, they can be seen in public together, yucking it up,
right,
and right, at court activities and things like that. But it's funny because the respect for the court at the court is high, but it's waning outside. There was a Gallup poll released, yeah, I think it was last week, or maybe it was the Marquette
poll. Down quite a bit.
And that's right, it is down quite a bit. But it's down quite a bit, especially in one sector, which is liberals and Democrats. And it's
right,
no wonder when their own leadership don't criticize the court for the court's work, but this kind of attack on them as a body. Let's go ahead and play. I want to play Sheldon Whitehouse, but before we do, I'll say this. I saw Biden. I didn't pull the clip. I saw Biden say he was talking about the abortion ruling, of course, which so many are. And he was talking about how he respects the Roe v. Wade and supports the Roe v. Wade decision. And I thought, it's an interesting way to say it. What I think he means is he respects and supports the right for a woman to be able to get an abortion if she wants one. But I don't think he actually respects that decision or reveres it. In other words, the decision itself.
It sounds to me like he respects
the decision. It's just the outcome.
It sounds to me like he respects the fact of the decision, the yeah, fact that it was a decision by the Supreme Court. So therefore, it requires
it,
a certain amount of support just by virtue of the fact that it was passed.
It's I mean, the Heller decision is the landmark gun rights decision. Well, everybody I know in the gun rights world is over the moon about Heller, but they don't support the decision. They support the fact that the Supreme Court finally recognized that the right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right.
Right. Well, I mean, look, I think that, you know, I lived through the days of the Warren Court in the 60s and into the early 70s. And, you know, conservatives complained constantly because the Warren Court was breaking all manner of new ground. But mostly they complained because it was a liberal court. And I think it's pretty simple. The left is complaining because you've got six conservatives or undecided in the case of John Roberts and three progressives. So they're outnumbered. So it's unfair. It's pretty simple.
It's not just unfair, Tim. It's a captured court.
I think it goes without saying that I have a rather different view of what is going on here than some of my Republican colleagues. There is a well-known practice of regulatory capture, where a powerful interest or industry essentially takes over a regulatory agency, and the regulatory agency then, thus captured, delivers decisions that benefit that industry that captured the agency. And I suppose sooner or later it was inevitable that minds of an evil bent would take the stratagem of regulatory capture and apply it to courts, and in particular to our Supreme Court. Now, obviously, one way you control an agency or a court is to control the appointments. And we know very well the Federalist Society turnstile that was run in the Trump administration that put three of these justices on the court. We know very well of the Judicial Crisis Network and its dark money funding that spent tens of millions of dollars related to Supreme Court appointments on advertising campaigns. What we don't know is who was behind all of this, who provided what the Washington Post described as $250 million in money to make all this happen. $250 million is a lot of money, and people don't spend that kind of money unless they want results. And we have no idea, because of secrecy, who is behind this scheme. The next thing, once you've captured an agency, that you want to do is to tell it what to do. And sure enough, we see national right-wing litigation groups that bring cases to the court. There is kind of an expedited fast lane for them to bring cases to the court that they think the captured court will rule for them on. Very unusually, they rush into court and say, "Your Honor, we'd like to lose. Please rule against me as quickly as possible so that I can get up to a friendly Supreme Court and we can get our policy work done there."
That's fascinating.
That's,
you know,
Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who's on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, who's picking and
he's talking about all these 5-4 decisions. It, you know, everything he said about Republicans and conservative justices and how it is benefiting the Chamber of Commerce and pro-life groups, whatever it is that are benefit, you know, right of center interest. You could say they use the exact same methodology on the left, which is get it up to the Supreme Court.
You're 1,000% right. I'm so glad you saw it just as plain.
He's describing their own modus operandi.
It's not just their MO. It's what they've done for over a generation.
They developed the art.
That's who Ruth Bader Ginsburg was. She was the Rutgers ACLU lawyer who had a fast track to the court for her cases.
Right.
This Ralph Neist, for the People of the American Way, used to do the same thing. I could tell you go on and on about these left-wing folks, and nobody, or not nobody, but serious court people watchers on the right and in libertarian circles never criticize them for their challenges, right? They criticize the court for their rulings. But this idea that somehow the arguments themselves, so like if conservatives band together to see their civil rights vis-a-vis firearms, for instance, recognized, somehow that's untoward or inappropriate or whatever for Mr. Whitehouse. But it's great if it's an abortion case. So that's somehow a celebration of American rights.
The bundling of groups, dark money donors, this stuff happens on the left to exactly the same degree, to probably a higher degree. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they play off the same playbook.
Yeah.
And when the Democrats control the court, Republicans complain and vice versa. And they say it's unfair. They've ruined the court. It's an imperial body, blah, blah, blah. I've heard it all for 50 years.
I just think that Mr. Whitehouse's criticism is that kind of criticism, not that we don't like the result or their reasoning is bad, but it's bought. The fix is in. This is the kind of thing that they're trying to get people to not sort of believe on the vaccine side. Right? I thought I wasn't going to say the V.
They're trying to bring down the credibility of the court to the point where they say we need to put more justices on to create a new paradigm, to create balance in the court, because Republicans have been packing the court, which is not true.
They're filling
vacancies that come up, but they try to call that packing the court.
Or do something else that you've talked about, which is to kind of like beat back Roberts to the extent that he's, what's the right word? Not shame him, but to disinvite him from their dinner parties.
Right,
or whatever,
right, right. They used to be able to do that, and it worked. But now Roberts isn't even a swing vote anymore.
Yeah.
So what he says usually doesn't matter.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. We've got, this is now Amy Coney Barrett's first full term on the court.
Right.
If you recall, You know, it's been such a whirlwind, right? But she was installed after the court had already started its business a year ago. And I think you're going to see a lot more from her this year. The, you know, the difference between that year and this year, I think will be the greatest difference in her sort of judicial life, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Her clerks are hired. She's read the cases and going to be, I think, more prepared to be the kind of justice that
also not going to face emergency pleas on the presidential election and have to decide on accepting or rejecting cases, you know, in an insane political atmosphere, just as she is sworn in during the height of a presidential campaign. All of that's so unusual that. Well, that's not going to happen again.
Tomorrow on the 1st of October to conference, and we'll hopefully get some more cases in case information sent down. They've accepted, Tim, in the 30s, the number of cases that they've accepted for this term. And most people expect that to basically double with new cases that they're going to accept. I will say that my favorite case to look at is Ortiz Diaz versus the United States. And this is the person of Mr. Angel Manuel Ortiz Diaz, who's a Puerto Rican who wants to engage in cockfighting, Tim. And he says that the federal prohibition on cockfighting is a violation of his First Amendment rights as well as other rights, and that it's no different from hunting, for instance, which results often in the death of an animal, at least to the success of the hunter. And why can't they fight cocks in Puerto Rico?
Spin it as something morally superior because you're at least the animals are deciding amongst themselves who gets killed, right? Instead of a hunter going out and deciding he's going to take down a deer, you get, look, the one cock wanted to kill the other. What are you going to do, right?
In defense of cockfighting, Timothy Elting Donner, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Uprising.
Never coming back. This will be my final appearance.
Don't say it. Cheers.
See you next time.
Well, that's it for this edition of The Uprising. Good luck to Tim, and thank you for listening and watching. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, the Rabbit Hole podcast, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit One Generation Away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.
We are the Uprising.